Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good morning, New Books Network listeners. I have a very special guest today, Dr. Peter Liddell, who's 89 and has written many books about British and European history, and also recorded a wonderful archive of first-person accounts of many important points, particularly of wartime history. Where Peter's 89 years old, and we are having some technical difficulties with this interview, which means that Peter's going to read my questions out and then his answers to them. So, accepting the limitations of the format, I'm now going to hand over to Dr. Peter Liddell, assisted by his wife.
Yeah, over to you, Di.
Richard, you asked me about how I would consider to have been the major features of my career. And I've thought about that, and I think undoubtedly the first thing would be the rescue of personal experience evidence for 4,500 people for the First World War and something like 10,000 for the Second World War. But mind you, that could not have been done without the indispensable help of two volunteer teams, one in the Northeast in Sunderland and then in Leeds, West Yorkshire, for the Second World War. It includes memories of people as early back as 1883, when I've been thinking about the first interviews I did up in Sunderland in about 1967. And then it led me to managing to meet and record over 25 of the Great War VCs and people from every walk of life, from poverty-stricken people to those whose names are household fame with regard to the First and then the Second World War. How was it done? Well, I suppose, yes, by a worldwide effort, because I went four times to France to interview French veterans of the war, to Turkey, to Germany, to Canada, America, Australia and New Zealand. So really, I did my best to record as widely as possible. Now, the thing that academically is as useful as the rescue of the material is that as diaries and original letters and photographs came into the collection and recollections by manuscript and typescript, as well as tape recording, I developed a cross-reference system which enabled me to assess the contemporary attitudes, opinions from these diaries of people's feelings towards the French, the Belgians, the Germans, towards political persuasion, towards conscientious objection, towards every manner of matter of opinion or attitude, and then also topics, not just major battles, but even to individual warships or merchant navy ships, and similarly squadrons, units of Army, Navy, and Air Force. So that cross-referencing of both opinions and topics was tremendously helpful to me in what I suppose was my third reflection, which is the books that I wrote based upon these contemporary evidence. And then I suppose finally, the thing that makes me feel that my work has been not just enjoyable and passionately pursued, but useful, is that I was able to collaborate with people like Hugh Cecil, John Bourne, Ian Whitehead, and then benefiting from the work done by scholars like Terrain and John Baines and Peter Simpkins, and also have an association through conferences and through books with so many different historians in a collaborative way. And I'd also like to pay tribute to the Halifax Military History Society, with whom I'm still collaborating in my 90th year. Now, I think you also want to know about how the origin of all of this, what was the origin of it? Well, in 1964, when I was a very happy and committed schoolmaster, I got some First World War veterans to come in to the school where I was teaching at the moment to share with the boys and girls some idea of what it was like to experience aspects of the First World War. But then when I moved into teacher training, what particularly struck me in Sunderland was the demolition of our history with regard to the shipyards, the coal mines, and glassworks and that sort of thing being closed down. What a loss this was to history. And it offended and inspired me at the same time. And then when I thought of the fact that most vulnerable of everything, not dependent upon councils demolishing some mill with all its history, was death. And the thought of so much memory being lost by death really did put my mind and those of my students and the volunteer team that I developed into a determined effort to rescue, before it was too late, so much of this material. I remember that I wrote a letter to the Telegraph in, I think it was some late in 1970, inviting people who had lived through the First World War to send in their readiness to be interviewed or their letters and diaries. And I got something like 700 replies, which was a wonderful but also a challenging commitment, which I followed up again with the help of that volunteer team. Now, then you might say, well, how was this pursued still further? And that's where I got a 90-year-old man to go right through who's who for anybody who was over 78 and would therefore have memories of the war. Then I looked through the Lady magazine and advertised for women who might have been in the VADs. I looked through socialist gazetteers to find anyone who was involved in conscientious objection. And through these gazetteers and following local and national newspapers for any hint that there were memories and perhaps documentation, that enabled me to capture so many more people. And then as my work became better known, and I might, for example, have been in Hampshire tape recording some admiral, he became so engaged in what I was doing that he would give me the addresses of perhaps five of his term mates at Dartmouth, and somehow I would get to them in interviews. As far north as Orkney, to give you new contacts. The method, well, I think the answer is inspired, as long as that's not too self-inflating, to think that if I want to get memories of people without reflections from a later maturity, I'd got to make men and women young again before getting to their First World War memories. And so I began with their birth and location date, the occupation of their parents, their schooling, college, university, first work in a factory or whatever. And I think by that time, by that approach, I made them young again. And I remember very well the daughter of a man to whom I sent the copy of the tape recording. She said, I heard a new father that I'd never known before, speaking with a strength in his voice and a vividness of description. And this had been because I had managed on this occasion to capture him as a young man again. Now, you've also asked me very reasonably about have I reflected upon my work in any way and thought about its validity as a source of historical material? And yes, I have. And I'm thinking that any historian worth his salt must attempt to be immersed in the values and attitudes of a period. And unfortunately, there are some historians who feel that today's very different values and the way we think about things is an appropriate way to approach study of the past, you know, and I think that's fundamentally wrong and leads to almost a disastrous reinterpretation of the past as the people who lived through the past would be strikingly affronted at the past being judged through the values of today. I remember also the need for what I think might be called proportionality, in that one of my first publications was a set of booklets for use in schools, and I had a very good relationship with an East Anglican veteran who had served in Gallipoli and Palestine, and he was dismayed to learn that this young friend that he'd got should judge that the war should be covered with a booklet equal in length on conscientious objection, equal in length to booklets of original documents on the Western Front, the war at sea, the war in the air. And I had a really good, sharp shock, a douche of cold water over my being enthralled by conscientious objection, because I felt that I'd done well to trace 8 men who had suffered the hearing the death sentence in 1916 in Brownsville. But there were 34 or 32 death sentences proclaimed for men in France who had refused to obey their military orders. So because they were in the field, as it were, they could be liable to the death sentence. And these 34 men endured that experience. And I remember, I suppose, as such an enthusiastic rescuer, being thrilled that I'd found these men. But I think that I made the misjudgment of being so thrilled by my discovery that the significance of this event, this series of events, merited the same emphasis as my work on the contribution of women, shall we say, in the war, or those soldiers in France and on the other fronts. You've asked me if I were to have changed my views or feel that I was wrong in any aspects of what I've written about the First World War in numbers of books. And I've thought carefully about this, and I think that, yes, there are regressively two areas where my judgment has changed. One is that because I became very interested, not extremely knowledgeable, but very interested in high command in the First World War, and felt affronted by the stupid judgments in the 1960s, oh, what a lovely war, and clerks, donkeys, that I became insufficiently aware that with almost all matters, there are two points of view. And in my thinking that the generals, by and large, with whatever errors they made, had a right on their side as against the politicians who then and subsequently so denigrated them. I think now I understand better that both politicians and generals had such enormous tasks with which they were dealing, and that very few men or women can be totally in the right and others totally in the wrong. I think perhaps my judgments there should have been mellowed with regard to the good work of the generals and the self-aggrandizing of Lloyd George as if he'd won the war on by himself. There's another smaller thing where I think that I would like to change my mind. Because I was so, again, annoyed at the fact that schoolmasters and media regarded the interpretation of the war as being solely properly exemplified by the great, by the poets of disillusionment, this found many undervalue their literary contribution and their expression of a percentage of reaction to the war. And I think that that led me to be too dismissive of them simply because of the way they were used to suggest that everybody felt about the war as they did. Regrets? Yes. I've always preached to other people doing interviewing, you must get yourself well informed about this, that, and the other. And there will have been occasions when I was inadequately informed. You know that the RFC, the RAF, RNAS is esteemed as the technical service, quite rightly so. And of course, there are aspects of artillery in the army and gunnery in the navy and navigation in the navy, which are also extremely technically significant And I don't think that I was sufficiently well-versed myself in those areas, and I regret that. And yes, so with regard to errors, I know of two errors in books of mine which I would dearly like to be expunged. I hope that I'm right in thinking that there are not any more than those two main authors. But also, in interviewing individuals, I tried rigorously to capture their individuality rather than their representative nature. But there will have been occasions when a man escaped the rigor of my attempted interview, and he presented himself as he would like to have done, rather than perhaps as he was. I remember very vividly an interview with a man in North Wales, and he had been an officer who had felt incapable of carrying out his duties in reconnaissance patrols between the trenches, and he confessed to me that he had gone to his CO and said that he was incapable of leading his men. And he cried as I was conducting the interview. My wife was with me, and she was horrified that I had reduced somebody to tears. And of course, I was distressed too. But subsequently, he wrote to say what a burden had been lifted from his shoulders by being able to confess something which had, for I suppose 50 or more years, had troubled him. So sometimes you get it right, but there will have been occasions when I got it wrong.
Good. Well, thank you very much. I'm wondering if there's anything more we can do. From my point of view, I think this is valuable and useful. So thank you very much.